You're listening to Longwoods Radio, your healthcare source for ideas, new policies, and best practices. The following is a Breakfast with the Chief session from November of 2008. Speaking on renewing public health in Ontario is Vivek Goel.
I thought what we would do is give you a little bit of a background on what public health is. I know there are a lot of healthcare system leaders here. I know there are a lot of people who know quite a bit about public health, but I found that many people's conception of public health might be limited. You see people worry about sanitation and sewers or just infectious diseases. So we thought we'd give a little bit of an overview of what public health has done and what it can do, and then talk a little bit about the history of public health in Ontario, how it got to where it was at the time of SARS, and then what's happened afterward. And one of the things is the creation of this new agency. So first, basic, what is public health? I think most people have a pretty good understanding that compared to health care, clinical medicine, and the health professions, public health focuses on the population at large, on wellness strategies. We use combinations of critical thinking to really assess whether interventions are the most appropriate. I think a couple of key points are that public health is built on partnerships. And when we talk about the model of the agency and creating a new structure for public health in Ontario, it's very much built on engaging many different kinds of organizations. And so it's great to see such diverse representation in this audience today. A little bit of the history. Can you see that? Okay. A little bit of the history of public health. In one sense, public health goes back a very long way. You can go back to medieval times and or beyond into ancient times and find that the concepts that we know very well in public health were being preached because many of them have a religious basis. So if you think of certain foods that are not consumed in different religions, they have a public health basis. Consumption of pork raw pork leads to trichinosis and other diseases, for example. Prohibitions on alcohol, certain kinds of sexual behaviors. You can go back to the Bible and find all these. You can find in pretty well any major religion. Concepts of hygiene and waste disposal. You go back to the Greeks and Roman times. People understood that to prevent disease, they didn't know anything about microbes, but they knew that certain engineering interventions could have an impact on health. Quarantine, the word quarantine is from the Latin for quarante, 40, and that was the number of days ships were held in harbor in Venice when they returned from the Far East. And again, they didn't know what people could be carrying, but they knew if you waited that long, anything that was on there, the people would have died. And the ones that are left alive, you could safely bring them to shore. All of those things have very ancient roots, but really there was no organization to public health. They were embedded in religion, in engineering, in harbor masters, and so on. It's really not until the 1800s that the basis of what is modern public health really started to emerge, epidemiology, understanding of germs, and the first preventive measures like vaccines. And it was really the previous century that saw the introduction of formal public health and the creation of public health units, public health departments, and so on. So while public health has a long history in terms of its concepts, in terms of its structures, it's a relatively recent sort of creation. And then when we come back to the history in Ontario, you'll see how that has had an influence on where we wound up right now. So I'm sure many people are familiar with the story of John Snow, who, again, is quoted quite often as the individual that really started the modern constructs around public health. This is a map from London, from the famous Broad Street outbreak. And this was a cholera outbreak about 1854 in London. And John Snow and others drew these maps. And, you know, at the time, you know, we talked about Google and Google Maps and so on. At the time, this was geospatial analysis. And I'll just, as an aside, I've had in the 4 or 5 months, I've had 3 or 4 GIS companies come in and talk to us about the wonderful things they could do in public health. And I said, you know, 160 years ago, people were doing wonderful things with maps in public health. What John Snow did was he drew little boxes here, and the height of the bars represent the number of cholera deaths, and was able to figure out that the place where people drew their water from was the Broad Street pump, and the intervention that they took was removing the handle, and the outbreak came to an end. And this was very important because at the time, people didn't think cholera came from water. There was this miasma theory that there was stuff floating around in the air. And what they were able to show was that it actually related to the patterns of where people got their water from. If it was the miasma theory, it should have been a concentric ring around whatever the source for this evil odor would have been. The other point that I think is important to think about is that at the time they took this action, and you know they had this miasma theory, he comes along and says, well, I don't think it's miasma, I think it's something in the water. But he doesn't really know what it is because no one knows what cholera is. The cholera microbe wasn't identified for a few years later. And they take action. And, you know, compared to what happens now in public health and in many other parts of healthcare, they didn't wait for lawyers to tell them whether they could take action. So, again, it's something I'd like to maybe come back to. So, to give you a flavor of the breadth of public health, one approach is to go through the great achievements. And the Centers for Disease Control in the United States at the turn of the previous century put together this top 10 list, or like a Letterman type list, of the great achievements of public health. And you could argue about which 10 things should have made it on here. But I think part of their thinking around selecting with this was to show the cross section of interventions that have had an impact. I won't go through all 10 of them, but I'll highlight what the impact of a few of these have been. So vaccination, and I think it's clearly one of the most significant public health and medical interventions of the last 150 or so years. And on a global scale, we show in a 20-year period the steps towards eradication of polio. You can see that in 1988, there were a large part of the world, countries had endemic polio, and by 2006, it was down to 4 countries. And that's the result, basically, of the immunization programs. Obviously, other interventions have also had an impact. At the same time, when we look at something like immunization, we also have to look at it with a little bit of care. This is from the UK, and measles rates after immunization was begun around 1970. And pretty dramatic decline in measles rate, and so clearly it had quite an impact on the number of cases. But if you go back in time, and you know everyone knows the lies, damn lies statistics or the manipulation that's possible, you can see that the vast impact that came long before immunization on measles death rates. And that is not, obviously, it's not to underplay the further impact of immunization, but obviously all these things came about not because of clinical interventions, but because of basic things like sanitation, education, nutrition. And so we, again, have to bear in mind that both our public health and clinical interventions have really come in after some of these much more basic interventions had a tremendous impact on society. And what it leads to, and this is something that's not only common for public health, but also, again, for clinical medicine, is that as newer technologies, as newer interventions are introduced, we move towards what's known as the flat of the curve in health economics. Measles vaccine on cost per case prevented was less than $10 a dose, a case. And if we factor in the savings for parental income and so on, if they don't have to take time off from work, it's actually a cost-saving healthcare intervention. We have very few of those. Over time, as we have new vaccines introduced, their cost per case is much more expensive. So the vaccines tend to be more expensive, and your impact tends to get smaller and smaller over time. And you can look at intensive care, cardiac surgery, anything. As you extend it out to greater range of conditions, you usually move further and further down this curve. Not to say that this is not an inefficient vaccine compared to a lot of other healthcare interventions. It's still a very efficient vaccine. But sometimes we get caught up in saying all childhood vaccines are great because of the earlier impact. And so it does mean that we have to look critically at everything that comes along. Motor vehicle safety, tremendous impact on the population. This is an example of the partnerships, right? Public health does not work alone, and you could even argue public health didn't really achieve much of the impact on motor vehicle safety. That's from highway regulations, enforcement, seat belts, obviously a major part of it, airbags, and so on, having an impact on it. But I think if you go back, you'll find that it was public health advocates, the American Journal of Public Health, first published articles on the potential for seatbelts. So public health often plays a catalyst role in some of these other domains. Similarly, in safer workplaces, occupational health and safety, public health has had a very close relationship there. And again, an interesting thing on this slide, you can see the motor vehicle-related deaths were actually the major costs of workplace deaths in the United States and remain so. And while most conditions declined over the decades, you see in red here, homicides went up. And so as another illustration here is as we get better and better at preventing or averting some of these more classic things, social types of issues start to emerge. And so we have homicides, suicides starting to emerge as the major cause here. Control of infectious disease, again, a huge achievement. You can see that the trend down really started at the start of the previous century. And here we have chlorination of water. And that's a major impact, again, as I said, hygiene, education, nutrition. And introduction of antibiotics, introduction of vaccines comes very late down that slope. Still has a very significant impact if you change the scale. The other important thing to look at in this slide is what happens towards the turn of the century. So at the 1960s, 1970s, there was the view that infectious diseases have been beaten. And you see that in the 80s, 90s, we have a reemergence. And I know many people in this room have heard me tell this story, but in 1973, we had a report here at the University of Toronto that written by the Vice Provost of Health Sciences, that actually recommended that the School of Hygiene be closed. And the report line starts by saying the infectious diseases have been beaten. The big scourges that society will face, chronic diseases, are going to be addressed by medicine and healthcare. So they were obviously wrong on both fronts. First of all, infectious diseases were coming back. In fact, the year that report was written was the year Lyme disease first emerged. We had drug-resistant TB, we had HIV, SARS, you can go on. And as we've come back to as well, the chronic diseases, certainly a tremendous impact from clinical interventions. But your new issue on obesity shows that we're going to have more than just clinical interventions for the chronic diseases as well. So we can see at the start of the previous century, in the 10 leading causes of death in the United States, infectious diseases are right there at the top, and five of the 10 are infectious diseases. We certainly have a major shift in 100 years where the top three are now heart disease, cancer, stroke. We have lung disease, and the top infectious diseases, pneumonia and influenza, and then HIV. So we've gone from five in the top 10 and three of them being the top three to two in the top 10 and much further down. And in relative terms, very small compared to the chronic diseases. And so that was the kind of thinking that led not only here at the University of Toronto to the closure of the School of Hygiene, but as we'll come to again in a few minutes, people's thinking that we don't really need public health, cut the budgets, cut the units. And so throughout the 80s and 90s, there was a very deliberate shift, not only in Ontario, but throughout the world, away from investments in public health, and particularly in communicable disease control, towards investments towards the more chronic diseases. Food. It says, is that where you download the milk? So food is obviously always an important thing. So one very significant public health impact is the pasteurization of milk. And it's had a tremendous impact on child health, the health of populations. And it's, again, interesting to see that in this day and age, we continue to have debates about is pasteurization a good thing or not. Just last month, we had a court case in York Region. There'll be another one in a few months. The provision of healthy fruit and vegetables and the introduction of farming techniques. Again, just last week, we had the Cancer Society questions about the use of pesticides and would the banning of pesticides on farms lead to a reduction in the availability of nutritious foods, which would have a greater impact on health than the effect of pesticides. And there was an editorial in the Globe, I think yesterday, which said very clearly we should worry about the health of the farmers and not worry about the food supply. I think that's a very significant public health question, not only for this country but for the world, because the impact of that nutrition on the health of populations is tremendous. Refrigeration and modern farming trucking techniques have ensured that we can get vegetables anywhere in the world, fresh fruit, oranges. Someone was telling me the other day about growing up in the prairies where you got oranges just at Christmas and you got one per person in the family and that was it. You know, now you can have oranges for everyone. At the same time, all of this has introduced new public health challenges. And so our new agency has been getting up and running as we've gone through in this province listeria and E. coli in the last few weeks. And the E. coli outbreak, you probably saw in the newspapers, lettuce, I think there's some lettuce in the back there, lettuce from California, packaged in large plastic bags and shipped across North America and winds up in restaurants all over southern Ontario. So while these modern farming techniques have delivered us safer, nutritious food, they've also increased the risks. And as we saw with the listeria and the maple leaf foods, the impact is much greater because it happens on a national, on a global scale. So if your local butcher had listeria on the meat, you might have a few cases in the neighborhood. When maple leaves contaminates its main plant that's shipping, you have cases from PEI to BC. And so their investigation, their management becomes much more complex. Now, this is my favorite. This is less than 50 years old. Doctors promoted smoking. And in fact, this one is less irritating. There are actually, you can find posters about the health benefits of tobacco. And so in the space of 50 years, we've gone as a society from doctors promoting smoking to doctors against smoking. And certainly the impact of public health working with many other organizations on tobacco consumption has been significant. But it also took a long time, 50 years. A lot of different kinds of interventions. So if you look at the first studies came out in the late 50s and the U.S. Surgeon General, early 60s, released a report that clearly laid out all the consequences of smoking. Advertising bans, taxation, all sorts of lawsuits against tobacco companies. And even as the overall trend line comes down, we know that in different age groups and different populations, we've had variable success. And so this illustrates that public health interventions can take a long time. And certainly sometimes they take a lot of different players, a lot of different organizations working together on tobacco. It's only come about because of a lot of different coalitions working with government and other agencies to have an impact. Maternal child health, again, same illustration here, tremendous impact on infant mortality long before we had neonatal intensive care units, prenatal care, and so on, although obviously they've also had a significant impact down the line. In some parts of Canada, particularly in First Nations communities, and we could see this for a number of other conditions, we're actually going back up this curve. And so while we're able to deliver the interventions here and bring mothers out of those communities, within the communities themselves, we're actually seeing these trend lines going the other way because of the lack of provision of basic public health services. And so, again, it's important to always bear in mind the full range of what's had an impact on some of these different conditions. And then the fluoridation of drinking water, and you know, I've had this talk for a little while, and it's one of the 10 great achievements. This is Dean of Dentistry. David, do you recognize? David Mock is the current Dean of Dentistry. And how many people recognize this guy? You'll all date yourselves. Gordon Sinclair was vociferous in his opposition to fluoridation. He'd be on his radio. It was CFRB, right? He'd be on CFRB every morning, and he'd debate the Dean of Dentistry and others. Evidence is really clear on the impact. Yet on Thursday, Halton Regional Council is going to be voting to stop fluoridation of its water supply. Niagara did it last year. There's going to be motions at Hamilton and London coming up. What is it that allows for a system that can take one of our most successful public health interventions and allow at a local level for the measures to be revoked? And again, in discussion, we can come back and talk a little bit about that. So I'll turn to the history of public health. I won't go through all the points here, but in Ontario, we evolved a system that enabled local municipalities to set up boards of health. And we went through a period where there were lots of boards of health. Every little village municipality had a board. And the province started to realize, and you get to the middle of the previous century, that you couldn't really deliver effective interventions with so many boards of health. And so through incentives, through grants, they tried to get municipal county-level health units. And they got to 54 boards. And, you know, there was further evolution. But the result was basically what we have now. We have an amalgam. We have health units that are at a district level. They cover a number of municipalities, and they're autonomous organizations. We have health units that are within regional governments, and we have health units that are within municipalities. And through the years, we've had various levels of funding from the province, ranging from grants at about 50% to at the time of the Common Sense Revolution and the Who Does What exercise, a complete downloading of public health services to 100% funding. Same time, you know, as I talked earlier, there was this thinking we didn't really need public health. A great illustration was around 2000, the Ministry of Health laid off almost all the scientists and all the microbiologists, but one of each, in the public health labs. And the minister's communications person is quoted, and it's, you can Google it, it's online. Why do we need a bunch of scientists sitting in the labs? We're not going to get any rare bugs in Ontario. It's about 2000 or 2001. So that's kind of where Ontario was, downloading public health, shutting down the services in the labs, and basically cutting the funding. And then we had SARS. And the story is very simple, I'm sure familiar. We have the index case of physician go to Hong Kong, Hotel Metropole in an elevator, interacted with a number of other people, and these travelers, because they were traveling to Hong Kong, after their visit, went back to all different parts of the world. And the thing to look at is that there, people went to many different places. And at the end, if you look at the bulk of the cases, were in the Far East, China, where it started, Hong Kong, and Singapore, and Taiwan. And we had one individual flew to Ireland and introduced cases into the European community. They had 33 and one cases, one death. United States, there was also a couple of travelers. They had 29 cases. Canada is the only developed country that received two cases, winds up with the same kind of outbreak that Singapore and Taiwan had, 251 cases and 43. And if we break it down further, it was actually a further natural experiment in Canada because virtually all of those cases and all of those deaths took place in Ontario. But the two cases that came to Canada, one went to Vancouver and one went to Toronto. So you have to ask the question, what was different about Ontario from BC and what was different about Canada from the United States, Europe, and some of these other countries? And in the way we do so in this country, we struck multiple commissions to ask that question. There was a judicial inquiry chaired by the late Justice Campbell, which looked at the impact on, particularly on healthcare workers, and also all of these legal issues around the interacting jurisdictional issues. Can you share information? Going back to my earlier point, how much should you listen to the lawyers before you decide whether you're going to act or not? And so he certainly had some very severe things to say. David Naylor, at the time Dean of Medicine, now the President of the University, chaired a national commission of inquiry and identified all these problems that had been building up over the years in terms of lack of capacity. And out of his report, we had the creation of the Public Health Agency of Canada. I just say a word about the Public Health Agency of Canada. On the surface, it has a similar mandate to our agency at a national scale. We both have agency in our title. But it is a different organizational construct than what I'm about to describe. The Public Health Agency of Canada is a department within the federal government. The head of the agency, the public health, the chief public health officer, is a deputy minister and reports to the minister. And so they followed some of David's recommendations, but not all. And David likes to say we've now got another experiment in this country between the ones that followed his report and the ones that didn't, and so Ontario did. So I'd also say, even though we talk a lot about SARS, there were other things going on that also identified the need for strengthening of public health. We had the Walkerton outbreak with water. We also had another foodborne outbreak at the around 2000 in Ontario, also related to meat. And we had a number of Legionnaires outbreaks. And so we had about eight or nine different reports, basically with a similar set of recommendations around the need to strengthen capacity in public health. And so we've had a number of things happen since then, including the creation of the agency, including increasing the funding by the current government to 75% for public health. You've called it actually gone down to zero, 100% municipal funding, and they've now come back up to 75. I think 2005, very important point, because concerns coming out of SARS, Walker and so on, we're going to focus on health protection, the infectious disease. And I think that was a very major issue in the federal report, the Public Health Agency of Canada, not just get caught up on communicable disease issues, the same in the provincial reports, and the Ontario government actually created a separate ministry of health promotion to ensure that there was attention to those areas. Led by Sheila Bazur, while she was Chief Medical Officer of Health, there was an exercise called Operation Health Protection, which had a series of recommendations, including the creation of the agency. I won't go through all of these, but just to emphasize that the creation of the agency was one part of a broader renewal of public health in Ontario. And many of these other parts have been acted upon, but there's still a significant amount of work to be done working with the healthcare system, particularly in areas like infection control. And we have C. diff reporting, we have MRSA and VRE coming in a few months, health human resources, and so on. And I think later this week, the Chief Medical Officer for Health is going to be releasing his annual report, which will focus on the progress made in this entire Operation Health Protection. So a few words about the agency. 10 minutes? Yeah. So first thing is the agency is created under its own legislation. So as I said, we're a different kind of structure than the Public Health Agency of Canada. There's no enabling legislation for Public Health Agency of Canada. It's a department created within government. Standalone legislation that was passed in June 2007 establishes a board that is appointed by Lieutenant Governor and Council. The chair of the board reports to the Minister of Health, and our chair of the board is currently David Walker, who's the Dean of Health Sciences at Queen's. And the CEO, myself, is appointed by the board, and I'm accountable to the board. While we have direct relationships with the Ministry of Health as well as with the other ministries like health promotion, environment, labor, and so on, we work on sort of our administrative level through a board. So there's a degree of protection for the agency and the ability that's now defined within our MOU with the Minister of Health for us to speak out on public health issues. So that was a very important point in the Campbell Inquiry, that any public health structure has to have enough independence that it will be able to take the next necessary actions. And the other important part of the legislation is that it sets out our objects, our scope, and they're very broad. They cover the breadth of public health, and they range from research to policy development, knowledge dissemination, maintaining laboratory centers. So the Ontario Public Health Laboratories, which have already started a process of renewal under Don Lowe, who went in about 3 years ago as the medical director, are going to be transferred on December 15th to the agency. And any of you that have been through a psych hospital divestment on either side know what it's like, and we're living it right now. But Don Lowe has already started a process. So from the one microbiologist and one scientist that were there at the time of SARS, there are up to about a dozen people, and they've got new equipment, and we've already started a major process of renewal that we will continue. We've also got an important element in our legislation to develop, collect, use, analyze, and disclose data. And so one of the critical issues that came up in SARS was people's concerns about sharing data and with PHIPAA and FIPA, and even at the university, I remember we had to decide, you know, our lawyer said I couldn't provide information when we had a suspected case in one of our classrooms, the medical officer of health. And I said, look, they're just going to come back with an order. Let's, let's exercise some discretion here. This, coupled with our classification as a health information custodian, under PHIPAA will enable us to do that bridging function, share data, and so on. We had a task force following all these various groups, Agency Implementation Task Force, which was chaired by Terry Sullivan, the president of Cancer Care Ontario, and co-chaired by Jeff Dunkley, who was then in Ottawa. And it laid out the blueprint for the organization. And we've been working from that blueprint. They developed a vision, mission, and mandate. And rather than reinventing these things, we've adopted them for the organization. And the vision is to be an internationally recognized center of expertise. And a few of us were talking about this outside. It's an interesting thing. We're set up to serve the population of Ontario. And should we be spending a lot of time focused on international, global issues? And I think it's important from two perspectives, and certainly the experience we had at ISIS. First, in doing our research, we want to have that international level of recognition, peer review, and having that actually gives you the local credibility. When you're going in and saying to people, change your practices, as we did at ISIS, if we're going to surgeons, change your approach to this. Being able to say that this is based on research that is internationally recognized really makes a difference. And the other piece, and it really is, we cannot ignore global issues. You saw my slides from SARS. So on the infectious disease side, it's obvious that those bugs aren't going to respect any boundaries of countries or provinces. But if we think of the chronic disease, and you look at the changing burdens around the world, I was at a workshop last night on the global burden of cardiovascular disease. And we'll look at countries like India and China with their shift now that we went through in the last century from infectious diseases to cardiovascular diseases. And we can see the same patterns that are taking place there in our own communities in this province. If you look at any of the work from the Inner City Health Unit at St. Michael's, they've got these great maps that show the burden of diseases like diabetes and heart disease by neighborhoods. And they relate them to various characteristics, and one of them is proportion of immigrants. And our neighborhoods with the greatest proportion of South Asian immigrants are the ones with actually the greatest increases in diabetes rates in the last 15 to 20 years. So in looking at building our agency, we obviously have to serve the mandate for Ontario, but I think in building it, we do have to also have a focus on international and global issues. Second thing in our mission, who we serve primarily are healthcare providers, public health system, and our partner ministries. So we're not a direct service organization. We don't serve the public directly. We serve the people who serve public health. And what we do is we provide scientific and technical advice to those people. So this illustrates a sort of where we expect to sit as a hub organization. So we have all the different levels of public health agencies, and at times there's a need to ensure good communications across those levels. We have a health system, healthcare providers, again, during SARS, and we saw it again during Listeria, the ability to get messages out to all family doctors. We still do not have a reliable system for an alert in this province to get to everyone as quickly as possible. The ability for public health to work with the healthcare system, and again, I'm sure many of you in this room are already interacting with public health on C. diff as the medical officers of health start to look at your rates and ask questions. And it's traditionally not been as great interactions in all the regions of the province. And then with the academic world. And public health, in this intersection here, between healthcare and the academic world, we have teaching hospitals, academic health science centers, and that's worked really well in this country. In public health, this intersection has never really worked very well. We've had teaching health units, FREDS, other programs. Our hope is to make sure we bring everyone together as a hub organization. So the great thing about starting a new organization is you get to build it from the ground up. And so we'll just illustrate how we've been going about. First thing is you have to have a governance structure. And so after the legislation was passed, we had a startup board started in the fall of 2007. And they did some basic work, and then the first thing they did was recruit a CEO. And I was appointed in March and started officially on July 1st. And then the next thing we need to do is to have a very solid foundation. So we got our roof governance, and we have to have a foundation. We have to be able to deliver all the services. And Denise Arsenowitz, Denise, was the recruited shortly after I started. Is our VP and Chief Administrative Officer, and she's recruited people in each of these areas and has laid out the foundation for our organization. As we said, we're going to be built on partnerships as a hub organization, and so we've got a major thrust, and events such as this are to reach out to as many communities as possible and to identify our potential partners. And Phil Jackson from the Ministry of Health is our Vice President for strategy and external relations. Then, as I said, we've had to focus very early on the public health labs. It wasn't meant to be that way. We should have been doing this about a year and a half earlier, and we would have developed all our thrust together. But because of some deadlines around the transfer of the labs, we've had to work on the transfer of the labs at the same time as we've been doing these other things. And as I said, on December 15th, we'll move the labs over. And we've started to work on building our surveillance and epidemiology capacity, the ability to turn out reports, and our emergency management support. And we've already done a little bit in the various outbreaks. We had an epidemiologist out in Niagara region helping them on their case control study that isolated that it was lettuce. And then through the labs, they were able to identify the specific organism. And these two are illustrated as cross-cutting because they're going to intersect with all the areas of the organization. And these are the remaining functional areas that we're building up: infectious diseases, chronic diseases, health promotion, injury prevention, and environmental occupational health. And then finally, we're going to have a significant knowledge exchange and communications presence. And Sonia Corkum, who was the VP for knowledge translation for CIHR, will be starting next week as our VP in that area. And I think she will be coming out to meet with many of you, and she'll be talking with you, Anton. So this just shows our sort of logic model, and I'll just highlight our two main activities through which we will achieve the outcomes we're aiming for: our knowledge generation, research, and knowledge exchange, which is the application of that research. In developing our plan, we're looking at ensuring that we look across the entire population continuum and a whole person approach. So we've got a lot of split now. People worry about cardiovascular, about cancer, about particular disease risk factors. And what's happening is we're losing sight of the whole person and what's known as One Health, which is cutting across veterinary medicine, environmental health. So the idea is to take a much more integrated approach, to use novel information communication technologies. And I think a key aspect, and I've seen it with these outbreaks, is the role of molecular epidemiology and genetics now in population health. And so we're going to try to bridge this bench to population. I've already talked about our focus on scientific excellence. We're going to look for projects that are bold and innovative, and we're looking at participating in the population cohort that's being launched, large-scale interventions. At the same time, in our knowledge exchange function, we have a lot to do to ensure that the best practice tools are out there, scientific supports, annual reports on health system performance, and so on. So I'll just close by saying and emphasizing again that even though we come out of SARS and we have a health protection mandate, as we develop the agency, we know that we have to maintain a focus on the broader areas.
This has been Longwoods Radio. Thanks for listening.